job with Howard's bio on it, and forgot to bring that. So I want to tell you a few things.
Good.
A few things that I know about Howard. This is a man with a huge heart and deep wisdom and extensive experience in working with groups around issues of change and transformation. Most recently, well, actually presently, he has founded an organization called New Possibilities Associates. And I'm sure after, at the end of the evening, if you're interested in that, he'd be happy to talk with you about that. But in essence, New Possibilities Associates is what four people, I believe, who are among, surely among the most creative in the city, working again to facilitate group change in a positive direction and to help people work through all the things that happen when groups begin to change and either don't want to or do want to or all of it. So welcome, Howard. We're so glad you're here. I happened to be at another gathering a couple of weeks ago where Howard brought up four questions from a book that he was familiar with. And the book is called Moral Imagination, The Art and Soul of Building Peace by John Paul Lederach. In the book, there are four questions or four capacities that have to do with moral imagination. That's what we're going to talk about tonight, and to bring it into the framework of the Buddhist tradition and Buddhist practice. So you're going to be part of that. We look forward to having you all join us. And I have the four capacities. I printed them off so that you could, I had 15 copies. If they don't go quite, they'll go almost all the way around. So, you want to start by reading this, saying something?
Yeah, but mark this a little bit. One of the things that I've done for the past 4 or 5 years is host a social change book club. We meet monthly. This book by Lederach was our December book. I would be surprised if some of you weren't at least familiar with it a little bit. It was featured in July on that 6 a.m. Sunday morning show that used to be called Speaking of Faith, that's now called On Being. That for some of us is the best thing on public radio.
When is that again?
6 a.m. Sunday mornings.
Thank you.
And the host, whose name is Krista Tipton, I think, was interviewing Lederach. And Lederach was starting to talk about these four capacities. Before he got to the third one, they were off on so many different other tangents from the book that they never said all four. He never said all four. And so I went to the website and downloaded the entire unedited interview, and he never got to edit three or four in that one either. So, and that's because the bigger question is, what is moral imagination, and what's its relevance to us, and how does it play in our lives, and when have we seen it in practice? Think about those words, moral imagination. What counts?
Well, I mean, a sense that we can move beyond what we see in front of us, the very limited and flawed ways in which we deal with each other, mm-hmm. As it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
sense of possibility.
Right.
I kind of see it as trying to get up a hill so you can have a broader view. You know, just continuing to move up and broaden your view and not be stuck in that dense area of what you've learned.
I feel like there's a responsibility inside that, those two words of the morality that we need to bring forth, and how do we do it? And it's there for us to find.
The term was coined supposedly by Edmund Burke. 18th century, an English parliamentarian who was writing about the French Revolution. The term is often associated with Martin Luther King and his call for a more just and equal society. President Obama used it in Tucson a few weeks ago in his remarks there, and he also used it in his acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize. When I think about who are the exemplars of moral imagination, and Nelson Mandela perhaps.
I think of the International Red Cross.
Yeah.
Doctors Without Borders.
Mm-hmm. The Quakers.
Yeah. So, what are the four capacities of the moral? Well, let me just say a little bit about Letterack. Letterack was raised Mennonite and is still practicing Mennonite, although he's employed at Notre Dame, which is an interesting. He works in the Kroc Center for Peace Studies, and I don't know whether that's Ray Kroc or Mrs. Kroc that endowed that. Tentatively, it was Mrs. Kroc because she was more into peace than he was. Ray Kroc was the founder of McDonald's, and he practices peace building. In Central America and the former Yugoslavia and various other, in Asia, various other troubled places in the world. So he's not just a scholar, but he's also practices this work. So he suggests that there's these four capacities. The first capacity is to be able to imagine oneself in deep relationship with people with whom we have essential disagreement. And that's really about two things in my thinking. It's about relationship. And it's about interdependence. Relationship. That if we're going to build peace, we can't build it unilaterally. All of the parties need to be participants. And the other thing is that we are so interdependent and interconnected that we can't save some of us. We can only save all of us. So, my sense is that that sense of interconnection touches a Buddhist note, at least.
It does, clearly. Yeah, sense of. First thing I think of is the interdependent arising. Mm-hmm. There are so many possibilities for reasons why certain things arise, but there's no way of working your way through that web.
Mm-hmm.
The interdependence is so strong. The other thing that I think of is the teachings of Pema Chodron, who says, go into what you're afraid of. Move towards it. If there's something you fear, you don't back off from it, you move towards it. Which is just, for most of us, counterintuitive, but very Buddhist. The willingness to be present with my spooks, my demons. Yeah.
So imagine the state of discourse in our public realm today. How would it change? What would it take for some of that capacity to be infused into our political dialogue or our public dialogue? How would we begin to see that we can't move forward unless we move forward together?
Puts me in mind of something I heard last week. It was an interview show with Lee Hamilton, who was the former representative from that district, Indiana. And he said one of the big problems in Congress is that they've shortened their work week, and they all get in there on Tuesday, and they have to work Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and they fly out Thursday night. And all the committee meetings, everything that goes on, it's just all crammed in together. He said in the old days, senators and congresspeople got to know each other. They had lunch together. They go to parties. They would, so you wouldn't call that left-wing blankety-blank son of a gun that's destroying America, because that's the guy you had dinner with the night before and met his wife and kids. And, and so the humanness has kind of been taken out of our representatives. And what we're stuck with is all these ideologues that really are just hammering away at what they think is right, and I think it's that in the lobby situation is really destroying our form of government.
Yes, Mark.
I heard a radio program today in which Hillary Clinton's comments were referenced, wherein she called yesterday, I think, on one of the morning Meet the Press shows or whatever. She called for the leaders of Egypt to sit down at the table with the people who are protesting, to sit down at the table with Americans who may be able to facilitate something. But there was general incredulous response among the radio viewers who called in to say, what do you mean the protesters would sit down with the old regime? I mean, some people couldn't comprehend that would be a plausible situation. And in fact, it's hard to grasp. But I think it's what you're talking about.
Exactly. So one of the stories that's really meaningful for me, it comes from South Africa. In that period of time, 1990 to 94, Nelson Mandela came back from Robben Island. The ANC and the trade unions were made legitimate again, legal again. And 94 was the scheduled date of the first all-race inclusive elections. And generally, there was pretty universal fear that there would be a bloodbath. South Africa around that time. And the joke at the time was that there's two ways we can get through this. The practical way would be for all of us to drop down on our knees and pray that a band of angels comes and makes it all right. The miraculous way would be that we learn to talk with each other and find our way through this together. And pretty much that was the way that it happened. And in in part because there was so much dialogue going on in South Africa at that time. And part of that dialogue was focused by a set of four stories, four future stories, scenarios, that were crafted by leaders from all across the political spectrum, from the ANC to the crypto-fascist Nationalist Party. And the four stories were four potential futures. One future was called Ostrich, where whatever the new government is, it puts its head in the sand and doesn't really deal with the situation effectively, so it lets it go on and on. And it breaks down because of that. Another one was called Lame Duck, where nothing was really addressed. Another was called Icarus, where the government nationalized a lot of business and heated up the economy real fast, and then it crashed. And the fourth story was called The Flight of the Flamingos, because flamingos take off slowly together and then fly high. And that's would be what it would take for the nation to succeed as an inclusive nation. And those four stories helped inspire the imagination of people all across that spectrum. That one, they are the four major choices, and we only survive in one of them.
Apparently there's a group that's formed that represents several politicians on both sides of the aisle in the U.S. I forgot what it's called.
Center Way or something like that.
To try to, you know. But, you know, I always think of these things, speaking of it, it's almost as if, it seems to me, the rhetoric in the U.S., unfortunately, I think it seeps across the world because our media is all over the world, pretty much. And I think that we have to kind of create a culture where it's not cool to be partisan. It's not cool to watch TV shows that, you know, that regardless of which side, that just creates a lot of negativity and demonizing people. You know, it's not cool. Like cigarette smoking is not cool anymore, or you know, I don't know. There's certain things that just aren't, people don't do like they used to, and it seems to me that there needs to be some sort of market demand that not happen. And I don't know how we do it, but I think it really has to be driven by the market to some extent as far as the media is concerned, because otherwise they drive, from my perspective, they drive the politicians who want to get attention and visibility do that often because they know that they'll get on a TV show or they'll get on a radio program and be able to, you know, get. So I'm just from the perspective, I think a lot of it is in our culture, in our media culture, and it's because we let that happen. We've gotten so accustomed to it or something.
I like to bring it in closer to me and you, in the sense that maybe it would be in the form of a question of what would need to change in my life, or how would I have to engage people with whom I disagree? What would that mean? With whom do I disagree, first of all? Who do I consider to be my enemies, or if not enemies, at least adversaries? And what would it mean in my life to talk with those people, to develop what deep relationship with these people. That's different from just a cursory conversation, a deep relationship.
I find that if I have people whose views I really don't agree with and can't think about accepting, it helps if I get to know that person and I really kind of ignore their views. The views are not deep. They're surface things. And it is possible to love somebody very deeply whose political, theological, moral views you thoroughly disapprove of. I did say once that I wouldn't vote for anybody who utilized negative election advertising. Unfortunately, that meant that I wasn't going to vote.
Yes.
But I would like to get a movement going for people who disapprove of negative election.
Which I'm going to use as an uncomfortable transition to the second one of these capacities, which is...
Another uncomfortable question.
Yeah. It has to do with what Lederach calls in the book paradoxical curiosity. It's the curiosity to not stop at seeing things as one thing or another, to not get caught in false dualistic polarities or schisms, but to hold the complexity that I believe was inherent in your comment, that people are more than political beliefs.
That sounds really like Keats' negative capability.
Say some more.
Keats, you know, John Keats, the poet.
Yeah.
Hold it all in your head without, you know, judging or ordering it, so to speak. I'm very crudely paraphrasing. It's from a letter he wrote to a friend of his.
The tension is that, you know, we are faced with views in our culture that are almost exclusively linear, mechanistic, materialistic, black and white,
either or,
Newtonian, Cartesian, that really suggest that, and Aristotelian, really. I mean, that's the basis of it. A or B, not A and B. You know, so it's really a challenge to be able to hold the whole thing at once. To be able to not just see it's on or off, it's white or black, it's good or bad, it's right or wrong. But to be able to hold all of those and their opposite and everything else.
You know, you remind me of this afternoon when I was listening to Robert Thurman.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about the experience of death and immediately post-death. And he was, I won't say this exactly like Robert did, but that people's experience after death, whatever they meet, is a projection of the gurus or the images that they have lived with and loved and have meant something to them. And that this is Buddhist, that regardless of whether a person sees Moses or Jesus or Krishna or whoever in the process of dying, that this is a Buddhist phenomenon. When you talked about inclusivity, that's I was reminded of that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had some dreams like that. And I think the dreams are kind of the nature of the fun. It's not one dream I had was you know, like a kind of dream I would have once or twice when I was young about a wolf. And I was in this place that was completely, actually it's on track with everything. Everything was dark and late at night, and this wolf was attacking me tonight. I would have reacted, you know, when I was young, but I wanted to protect myself, but I didn't want to have the wolf. So I let him jump over me. The once I jumped down, and then he jumped again. He was about to, and I was throwing up my arms. I think he's going to bite my arm. But then I woke up. But I've had two or three other dreams where it seems like that part of me, because when I hear some of, even read about some of the people that I have problems with, you know, it really hurts me. Clothes are all off. And so I think as we mature, we begin to realize, you know, these are, because a lot of what we also, everything is an opposite. And, you know, our shadow side is that too. And I think that's important.
Third one is the belief that it will take an act of creativity, not an act of technical expertise, to find a solution. That we need to be able to invoke the intuitive, the artistic, the creative in the search for peace, for solutions. Because if there was an off-the-shelf solution, or a technical solution, or a linear solution,
or a policy solution,
chances are it would have become obvious a long time ago. So it really takes calling on the artistic self and the creative self to bring a new solution into the world.
This is accessing the other half of the brain.
Yep.
Accessing the other ways of learning besides linear learning.
Absolutely.
I liked your story about the four stories current in South Africa at the time when multiracial voting started. Maybe we need the creativity to create stories like that for our times. And they might almost be the same stories. But it seems to me that there are too many of us, people. How to disseminate the stories?
The thing that really bothers me from an emotional standpoint, people seem so angry and they seem so prickly. You know, that a good example was my wife, in the neighborhood there's a sauna, and some people are generous enough where on a Thursday night, people who want to can go and sit there and sweat. I grew up in Miami, I don't need to do that. but anyway, they were sitting there, the three of them, and this one guy's talking about getting a truck, and then he jokingly said, I might even get a Confederate flag. So I'll fit in here in Indiana, you know. And the other guy just all of a sudden got so indignant and started talking about the stars and bars and all the brave people that died for the South and all this stuff. And it was like, what? Something you can't even have a peaceful soak or a peaceful sweat. That there's just so many areas where the buttons can be pushed. And that leads to this question, what you're talking about in number three. How do you get people to calm down and open their hearts and listen deeply and then come to conclusions together? How do you, I mean, you've facilitated obviously groups like this. How do you get them to that point?
Well,
I want to speak to that later, but
go ahead. Well, you can start first.
Well,
we're going to say the same things. If we don't be my guess.
The Buddhist tradition would say, start with my own heart.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Start with my own anger. Start with my own reactivity.
Right.
That's the only place to start. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just the other side that has that, but it's a reflection of mine.
Right.
And this is the place to start right here.
Sure. Well, I guess what I was saying was, I imagining being a facilitator with a group, like imagine the House of Representatives, if you want a large group or a smaller. I mean, mm-hmm. How do you get these people to do that?
You don't get anybody to do anything, in my understanding. You become it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it really is about creating a container that people choose to enter where they behave differently and allow new possibilities to happen in that container. And part of it is the intention that the people share when they enter the container there's a disturbance, a problem, an issue that matters to all of us. And so we come with that intention of finding a mutual solution. And then it doesn't happen fast. I mean, it happens, you know, there's this sense of that the more people speak, the more wide apart, you know, it seems like you're getting diverged. And there's a lot of great stuff, you know, that's come out, and a lot of important stuff that's not come out. And the next challenge is to hold people in that paradox and chaos and ambiguity and stay in dialogue with one another. And not try to close it down as soon as it gets to seem unwieldy, because it will get to seem unwieldy. And not to close it down when it's in this chaotic, ambiguous, paradoxical space, because that's where the new stuff emerges. Mm-hmm. That's where transformation takes place. And the image I find comfortable for me is, it's like, how do you grow a crystal? You grow a crystal from a tiny seed, you know, in a supportive medium. You know, it's how a pearl grows, you know, the same, it takes that grain of sand and, you know, place in the right place. But it takes some seed that's found among all that stuff that came out in the beginning, you know, and people find a crystal, a seed that's worth growing a crystal around. And from that, that's the transformation that emerges out of the chaos. And from that, they can begin to converge. Literac says that this work is not like, it's not like negotiating a settlement. I mean, building peace is a long, long term, you know, multi-generation in some environments undertaking. And he tells a story, and I won't get the punchline correct, but it's something like the people at Notre Dame ask him about, you know, this is such long-term work. Why, you know, it requires you to keep going over it and over it and over it. You know, what's with that? He says, well, it's just like mass. Yeah. Gotta keep going up.
Well, and it's another analogy, I think, is how long it takes us.
Yeah.
To, mm-hmm. you know, because you think, you know, you practice meditation and you become more conscious, you try mm-hmm. to become more conscious of your behavior and the way mm-hmm. you went, and then you think you're doing fine, and then one day you get really pissed off. And you think, oh God, I thought I'd gone beyond that. And I, it just, it, It's like everything's a work. We're a work in progress. I think that it's the intention to be the work in progress, you know, in the process, yeah.
I see myself disconnecting the buttons one at a time, you know, so that I can stand things without getting pissed off that I couldn't 6 months ago. But there are still buttons that still wired up.
Yeah.
But it's encouraging to see that the bar keeps going up, that I can do things that I might not have done 2 years ago.
Can I ask you, I felt some resistance a few minutes ago when you were talking about the trying to find the new solutions, using creativity to find. I think it's perfectly clear what the solutions are. I mean, I think they're the same things that have been proposed for millions of years, and it's just kind of recognizing that your neighbor is yourself and wanting good things for all people. But my question is, why is that so? Why do we keep looking at the edges for new solutions when, in fact, I think so many people have come through to us through time who have shown us, and we go, oh, Jesus knew, or Gandhi knew, or my next door neighbor knew, or, you know, but we resist the perfectly obvious in our effort, I don't know, to be greedy or whatever it is that, but why do we think of this solution as being something we haven't yet struck on?
So we can reframe it then. What if what has to be new and creative is not the essence of the solution, but the surface of the solution has to have the right receptors on it to fit the DNA of the current situation? I mean, it's the same nucleus.
This makes me think, and the question made me think about cross-cultural programs where they bring, particularly they do it a lot with kids together in an arts situation, so they're making music together, or they're creating stories together, or they're creating art together, and then suddenly, you know, the fact that, you know, somebody's from Israel and somebody else from Palestine, you know, it just seems less.
But and that's kind of what I was staying at in a kind of an oblique way. Finding the ways to make it fit in the current situation, to make it real, to make it apparent, so people can apprehend it.
Thanks, that's helpful. I think I see it better now.
Okay. The fourth one is has two parts to it for me. It has the element of mystery. And risk. And the fourth one is about, you know, whatever we end up doing, it asks us to take a risk to step into the unknown, into mystery. Because there's no sure thing at the end when you take your first steps. I mean, it is so much of illuminating or creating a path by walking it. There is no full path ahead of us. With each step, we create the path. And so to take that risk of not standing still, of moving with the intention, and stepping into that mystery is the fourth capacity.
And what I'm reminded of, other gathering where you and I were both, there was a person who brought up the story of, was it Detroit? Was it Chicago?
Yeah.
Where there was some data that had come to light that between 6 and 9 or 6 and 10 p.m. was the highest crime time in certain areas of the city. And there were certain areas of the city where crime was a bigger problem than in others. And there were people who decided to go simply be willing to walk the streets in that area during those times, just to be present and walk the streets and see what happened. what happened, I don't know over what period of time, I don't know how long it took, but the crime rate plummeted just because people were willing to be present, to put themselves out there and walk the streets. And this was a person who then said that they would be willing to do that. And it was breathtaking to me to hear that kind of courage, that a person would be willing to go out on the street and simply walk in hopes that their presence would. Now, talk about risk. That was just quite amazing to me. A
couple more ideas that I think have touch on various aspects of a Buddhist tradition would be that in order to practice these four capacities, one also has to cultivate the capacity for stillness. And stillness is not inaction, it's action without movement.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important, the ability to be, and we always talk about this, every week. The ability to sit with it just as it is.
Mm-hmm. And to become deeply aware of what it is.
More and more aware.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Without reacting. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Howard, he says that in the book? Okay.
Yeah, because he devotes a good third of a chapter to stillness.
Okay, because I thought, I'm sitting here the whole time thinking about the container and people inside. I'm thinking of people like folks in Rwanda whose neighbor went against neighbor and killed each other's children or what, you know, this container. And I can't help but wonder, there's got to be something else. There's got to be another layer to this, you know, and that's the layer I guess I was looking at. You have to address the individual aspect of the hurt and the
Absolutely.
Anger. And I guess this is what helps you say
that. And his view of time, touches on that as well. He quotes somebody else who I can't name, who came up with the concept of the 200-year present. And the 200-year present would be the time from the earliest memories of the oldest person I've known to the last memories of the youngest person I've known. That span is all the present.
Can you say that again?
From the earliest memories of the oldest person I know to the latest memories of the youngest person I know is about a 200-year span. And all of that is present. And for many of the people in the kinds of situations you were naming, that present is the future. So that atrocity that happened to the oldest person I knew is the present and the future for the youngest person. And so, dealing in that kind of a time frame, it's a timelessness. It's all now. Which, again.
It gives a frame for the notion of patience, not patience in the sense of waiting for something to happen, but patience. Just abiding.
Yeah.
Just abide, simply abiding.
Mm-hmm. And he talks also about pessimism. People in those kind of situations, you can't expect optimism. And when the diplomats get together and come up with a negotiated settlement, there's going to be pessimism. Because a negotiated settlement is not peace. You know, you have to build peace to get to the table, and then you have to build the peace that was negotiated in that settlement after you leave the table. You know, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water, after enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. You know, this peacemaking goes on and on and on.
That I run up against, that would be so difficult for me, is developing the willingness to sit with what I am experiencing internally. Mm-hmm. On and on and on, mm-hmm. to be present with mm-hmm. that when it sometimes is so incredibly uncomfortable. Anger hurts inside. Sadness hurts. Developing my task of developing the ability, the willingness to sit with my own discomfort around that.
Sure.
Yeah, I was thinking of reading and going to meditation groups and speaking all this. It's all like, personally, it's like the mechanics of moving forward. Answers to be like she suggested, but we'll be discussing some mechanics moving forward.
Interesting that you said that. The guy who facilitated the Mount Fleur scenarios in South Africa, Adam Kahane, his second book, I think it's called Power and Love, used that metaphor. As the organizing metaphor in the book, that it's almost like learning to stand erect, learning to take a step, learning to walk, learning to move with fluidity. You know, that and it talks about his efforts in peacemaking. Some that they were barely able to get erect.
Seeing it in ourselves and in our communities, and then we're seeing it on a global scale. But things have, it's all coming together, and it's all happening. We're all one, and it's all happening to all of us. Mm-hmm. And things have to just shift. And I think what you're talking about is the only solution. And I think that there's many different spiritual, I just feel like you're led spiritually, we're all being led, there's all kinds of spiritual assistance coming in many different ways. And I think this is, because I was just looking back at the Conversations with God book with Neil Walsh, and I have never joined his community, because I know they have them all across the world, but I sense that it's kind of the same thing. It's that sense that it has to be community, people, one person, two people, four people, eight people, 10 people, saying we're not going to put up with the judgment and the dualistic thinking and the I'm right and you're wrong, my group is better than your group, and And it's got to come from a sense of here. It's got a sense of the, you know, the love. It's got to come from a sense of love, love for ourselves, love for all of us are one. But I just feel like we are showered with many, many solutions, and they're out there in many different directions in many different ways. And it's happening right now.
I'm imagining that the discomfort you speak of and the frustration and the that is the transition, this is the process. In other words, that maybe we think we have to do something else for it to happen. And it's in the being with what's right here, this messy stuff. It seems like that's what it is.
This group, meditating is probably my main, you know, reading and learning and praying and all that I can do. But it's this learning to meditate and learn, like what does my teacher Glenda, learning to do this. I mean, this is extremely powerful, extremely powerful. It's the only way I know. To know that my spirituality starts here. And,
it's the way that informs you.
It's the way that informs me.
Well, and Howard, I was just thinking when you were saying that the present 200 years, that applies, I think, to each of us individually. You know, that when we come into a room and we sit down and somebody says something and suddenly we're feeling this stuff. That's, in a way, it's what do you call it? Everybody has their shit, so to speak, you know? Mm-hmm. It's kind of, I find that similar to the 200 because, you know, it's, you know, you are who you are through genetics and social and the whole thing. And, you know, from, I don't know, that's just what I was thinking. And this just, again, this abiding with this 200 years of presence, you know, that you yourself.
200 years of shit.
Yeah. That you yourself, right?
It staggers the mind.
But it is a bouquet. You're not just one flower. You're a big bunch of flowers. Kind of easier to convey.
Weeds. No.
I like that we've been using the word abide. I think Glenda started that a few minutes ago. Because the thing that is so interesting about meditation and Buddhism is that it gets you out of that drunken monkey that is your mind. And that you know, there's so many beings on this planet that believe all the stories that are being conjured up. And, you know, just to be able to sit. You know, I read somewhere, maybe it was one of your emails or something, a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. They asked him if you had 10 minutes left to live, what would you do? And he said, meditate. And I don't know why, that just keeps coming back to me, you know, since I heard it. But it's like, yeah, you know, just to get quiet and to get still and to be who I am when I am everything, you know, to kind of get Ram Dassian on us. You know? But, you know, it's, I think that if we could find a way to help the world to just not believe all the monkey stuff, you know, and just chill, to use that expression.
I'd like to piggyback on that. I've been listening to the Winter Feast for the Soul meditation sessions that you recommended, and one of the recent ones concluded with the thought that as we practice meditation, what we're really trying to do is to develop the skill and the discipline to stay focused. And our world and our culture don't really help us do that anymore. It's all about being exponentially, you know, more able, more creative, more whatever. But our practice is so simple, and it's the discipline of returning to the source again and again and again. But it's just like you said, it's it's a gift and it's hard. You just reminded me.
This work that I'm doing now, helping groups deal with chaos and disagreement and high levels of uncertainty, it's a pretty iffy financial venture, frankly. Because nobody, given the choice between dealing with that and believing that it's not happening, most people would believe that it's not happening. Yeah. So, you know, my potential clientele are people who are no longer believing that they're not in high levels of chaos, disagreement, confusion. And so, if you imagine the curve, that means people at two ends of the tail, either people who have already achieved a degree of clarity to see that whatever it is that they have been doing doesn't work anymore and they need to do something else. Or they are in such intense crisis and they've tried everything else and they don't know what's going to work, but whatever it is, they've tried everything else, so I might as well try this too. You know, and so to believe that we could move the middle, I think it is a frustration in the making that the middle moves very, very slowly. And I'm happy working at the two tails and hoping that the two tails move in toward the middle. Is it time for me to do a little commercial? Have I already done a little commercial?
You've done it, but you can do it a little more.
Yeah. If you're interested in the stuff that I do, I will have cards available. If you want to send me an email, I will add your name to my mailing list. And you get two emails a month. One is the books for the book club. And one is kind of a newsletter with two or three articles about dealing with chaos and change.
I'm on that email list, and I can tell you that all of those emails are extremely engaging. Yeah. Anything that feels left undone or unsaid?
I just had Cicely and Maxine, the orchestra play, and it was wonderful the other night. And it reminded me of how our mind just wanders off, because here's a beautiful music, and you're paying attention to it, and then your mind, it was just like meditation, and then your mind wanders into this, and you come back, and you think, what a waste, how much did I just miss?
That's right. Yeah. That note that I just missed was the best one. I was thinking of the little orchestra when you were talking about.
Yeah.
Groups with these two tails in the middle that won't move.